Hello, I'm Robert Bateman, and this is the Privacy Corner, where I talk you through my top three picks for privacy developments each week. And thank you, as always, to Privado AI for sponsoring the show. So this week, I'm looking at the CCPA's enforcement advisory on data minimization and consumer rights. Google has finally settled its incognito class action by agreeing to delete billions of data points, and the ICO has announced it will be focusing on children's privacy in the coming years. So we'll see what that means in practice. So the CPPA, the California Privacy Protection Agency, has put out an enforcement advisory about data minimization in the context of CCPA consumer rights requests. This is supposed to encourage voluntary compliance, but the CPPA says that stronger medicine will be in order if it doesn't work. So there's a lot of disclaimers here about what the enforcement advisory isn't. It's not legal advice, it doesn't make law, it doesn't interpret the law, it doesn't create policy, but it's quite a helpful document, and this is quite a tricky area. There's kind of conflicting obligations to not collect too much data and also to make sure consumers are who they say they are when they're exercising their rights. So the CPPA says it has observed that businesses are asking consumers to provide excessive and unnecessary personal information in response to consumer rights requests. And the CPA's data minimization principle looks quite different from that under the GDPR. It doesn't actually mention minimization, but it says that the collection, use, retention, and sharing of consumers' personal information must be reasonably necessary and proportionate to achieve the purposes for which it was collected and compatible purposes and so on. That means, well, that's spelled out in practice in the CCPA regulations, where they give three kind of factors to think about: how much data you need to achieve your purposes, the possible negative impacts on consumers that result from processing more personal information than you need, and the existence of additional safeguards to secure personal information, for example, that you collect. The advisory note highlights some passages of the regulations and the statute. There's a bit of an emphasis, I think, on the right to opt out. Businesses should not really be verifying right to opt out requests. The regulations are quite clear on that. And they do mention that you could ask for a name if you need it, for example, but not photo ID or anything like that, because the risk is low when fulfilling a right to opt out request. It's not something many businesses want to do, but it doesn't have any adverse impact on the consumer necessarily if it's fraudulent. Whereas if a consumer or someone pretending to be a consumer is requesting access or deletion of sensitive personal information, the risk is much greater, the bar's higher. You might need to apply a more rigorous verification method. There are some good hypotheticals in the advisory note. I recommend reading it, and it also, I mean, it kind of guides the reader through the appropriate sections of the law and the regulations. So, questions to ask yourself when doing verification and just setting out all the principles quite clearly. I look forward to seeing the next in this series of enforcement advisories, as they're calling them. Next up, Google has been dealing with a class action for the last few years related to incognito mode in Chrome. This is Brown v. Google, and they've come to a settlement. It hasn't been approved yet. That will go to a judge in July 2024, but the terms and the history of this case are both quite interesting. So let's talk about the background. It started with a 37-page complaint filed in June 2020, alleging that Google was collecting private browsing data. Google was very robust in its defense against these allegations to begin with. Specifically, the plaintiffs found that when they visited a website in incognito mode, they would still be tracked by Google's tools on third-party sites. So incognito mode doesn't record your session history in your web browser's history, but it also doesn't protect you from Google Analytics or Google Ad Manager, for example. So these are Google's own tools on third-party sites, and there was some allegation that the information about incognito mode implied that it was more private than it really was. That information has changed since this case was filed, as we'll see later. So the standard defense from Google was that it aggregates the data, effectively saying it's anonymous. The plaintiffs have some very biting language about this. Google's nefarious uses of the data. Basically, the evolving understanding of privacy in the US means that this kind of defense is not going to work anymore, I don't think. The point of Google Analytics is attribution and measurement, so Google could, in theory, identify people from their presence on a website regardless of whether they were using incognito mode. There's no essential difference in that regard. The suit cites these standard set of sort of Reagan era wiretapping laws and torts, invasion of privacy, intrusion upon seclusion, Federal Wiretap Act, the California Invasion of Privacy Act. We see those laws all the time in these US class action privacy cases because they give rise to a private right of action. They didn't mention consumer protection law, despite alleging that Google was misleading consumers with its messaging around incognito mode. So I'm not sure why they excluded that. Perhaps there's a good reason. The settlement, Google filed two motions to dismiss this case, both failed. It was a very long, drawn out discovery process, and Google was sanctioned at one point for failing to produce evidence required of them. They had to pay the plaintiffs nearly $1 million in fees in 2022 over this. One of those pieces of evidence was called a private browsing detection bit. There were four of these bits, as they're called, and they can detect whether a user is in incognito mode and then also label data collected about them when in incognito mode as private. So Google, as part of the settlement, has to stop doing that, delete those bits, also has to change the language it uses to describe incognito mode on what they call the splash screen. So this is the new tab when you open incognito mode. And there was evidence produced in discovery as well that employees have been concerned about this language for a long time, being unclear about what incognito mode does. So this, if you're watching, is the new tab page that I saw last night in incognito mode. It does now say that websites you visit and the services they use may collect data, including Google. So that's kind of an admission, as it were, that Google's own tools might be able to track you when you're in incognito mode. They also turn off third-party cookies by default now as a result of this case. Google must delete a lot of data that it's collected from people using private browsing, and they have to make further amendments to the language they're using to describe how private incognito mode really is. There's no payout at this point, but there is scope for individual damages claims from each of the class members. So this might not be the end of this story for Google. The Texas Attorney General also has a similar case about this going on. So I think this will run and run. Finally, the ICO in the UK, the Information Commissioner's Office, has said it will focus on children's privacy, specifically with social media and video sharing platforms. And this is what they're calling a new children's code strategy. So the children's code is a code of practice under the UK GDPR, and it was adopted by Parliament 2021, I think. And it applies if your online services are likely to be accessed by children. Now, that is a very tricky measure. If you're watching, I've put a shot from the ICO's guidance on this, how you can tell whether you're within the scope of this code of practice. And essentially, the ICO often falls back on, well, if you're using age verification, then you'll know whether kids are accessing your site. There is some other tips here, peaks in access around school holidays and after school, internal analytics, market research. The Children's Code is trumpeted as a great success by various politicians and the regulator itself. The changes made by various social media companies are often cited. They took place in the run-up to the code. I'm perfectly willing to accept that's why they did it. Facebook and Instagram, for example, changed how they target ads at under 18s. They also asked for people's date of birth at sign-up. The ICO does incidentally say that's not considered an acceptable age verification method in itself. Instagram put in some parental supervision tools. YouTube turned off autoplay by default for Google accounts for under 18s. Now, the going forwards, this particular scheme, they'll be focusing on four things among social media and video sharing sites: default privacy and geolocation settings. So default privacy settings on, geolocation off by default, profiling children for targeted ads, using children's information in recommender systems, and processing information of children under 13 years old. There's some discussion about the commissioner's attitude towards kids' privacy in the TikTok enforcement notice and MPN from last year. The code wasn't in place during the relevant period for that decision, but they do also have a preliminary notice against Snap for some sort of AI thing, and that involves children. We haven't had sight of that notice yet, but we'll get a full decision eventually, presumably, unless they drop it. So that's all from me this week. Thanks so much for your attention, and I'll be taking a week off next week, but I'll see you the week after that. Thank you again to Privado AI, and I'll see you all soon.